I'm David Crow, and this is The Infectious Myth. Thank you for being a listener. If you have a comment or want to suggest a future guest, you can email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. You can like us on Facebook at The Infectious Myth or follow us on Twitter at Infectious Myth. We're on iTunes and other podcast programs, and I certainly want to hear from you. In episode 35, I interviewed law professor Deborah Turkheimer, author of the book Flawed Convictions, that questions whether classic shaken baby syndrome convictions based on a triad of internal neurological symptoms are valid. Shortly after that interview, I received an email from Lori Frazier, today's guest. She's an MD and professor of pediatrics at Penn State Hershey Children's Hospital in Pennsylvania. She started her email by saying, "I was pretty concerned by your interview with Professor Turkheimer on November 4th. She presented a highly inaccurate picture of the medical approach to these cases. As a physician, I would not presume to speak to legal matters. Her medical knowledge is simplistic and inaccurate, to be clear." We'll get into some of her more specific concerns later, but I immediately contacted her to arrange an interview to get the other side of this important issue. Dr. Frazier was recently hired by Penn State Hershey Children's Hospital to lead its new division of child abuse pediatrics. She received an MD from the University of Utah in 1983, did a residency in pediatrics at Seattle Children's Hospital in 1986, and a fellowship in child abuse pediatrics at Harborview Medical Center in 1989. Welcome to the show, Dr. Frazier.
Thank you very much.
I'm pleased to have you with me so that we can get a different perspective on the whole issue of shaken baby syndrome. And first of all, perhaps we could talk about why it's now called abusive head trauma. I believe that was around 2009 when the American Academy of Pediatrics said that the name should be changed. Why was that?
It was changed because we're seeing children who were abused, who, for example, were not shaken, who were impacted, slammed against things, and they clearly had abusive injuries. We saw kids whose heads were crushed when people stomped on their heads. We were seeing children who were apparently shaken and then had impact injuries, and children who had injuries that we attributed to shaking and didn't have any other signs of impact. So we wanted a more inclusive term that included any kind of abuse that affects the head and brain, because these kinds of abuse that are directed against the head actually cause significant problems, deaths, and long-term disabilities,
right,
more so than other forms of abuse.
Right. I think everybody's pretty clear that if a baby is slammed against a wall, two things. First of all, obviously, that's going to seriously harm the baby. But secondly, there would be external signs of abuse, whereas shaken baby syndrome was limited to the cases where there were no external signs of abuse.
Well, actually, that's not true. That's another thing that I feel that we need to set the record straight.
Okay, well, in 2009, you wrote a paper where you said, maybe you can tell me where I'm going wrong. You said, "John Caffey, the father of this kind of diagnosis," was my words, "continued to observe and collect cases of children who were apparently seriously injured with fractures and head trauma. In 1974, he published his seminal paper. In this study, he described cases, etc. He emphasized that a prominent feature in many cases was the lack of external evidence of abuse." And so are you saying there are not cases where there's no external evidence of abuse, or that those are a minor number of cases, or what are you saying?
So in about half of cases, there's external evidence of abuse. And I think that was Caffey's perception, that he was seeing children who probably were developing what they called chronic subdural hematomas, and he was a radiologist, and he was x-raying them, and he was seeing they had this evidence of old blood in their head and healing fractures. So most of the children that he was seeing for their heads were growing abnormally rapidly, and he discovered this chronic blood in their head, not necessarily acute blood. And so he was seeing kids in somewhat of a delayed situation. So, of course, he would not see necessarily acute findings, but he remarked at that especially back in the 40s when he first published his paper,
right.
he wasn't as interested in calling it abuse because there wasn't laws that protected physicians from calling things abuse. And so he felt like there was some traumatic event that led to these children's injuries, but he couldn't see any external sign of injury.
Right. But you're saying that in your experience, about half the time you see external signs and half the time it's limited to internal symptoms?
Correct. I mean, that is correct. And that's what my experience is, and also the studies show. And, you know, about half the time kids have bruises and other signs of external injury. And about half the time they also have fractures or internal injuries. And another percentage of time they have other organ injuries. So we're a lot better nowadays than Kathy was even in 74 at doing better testing and looking more carefully for subtle injuries.
So you're saying you can find external injuries that would have been overlooked before?
Yes. The other thing we understand now that we have more complete forensic investigations, that when children pass away, when they die from injuries,
right.
we may not see anything externally. And on all of our imaging, on all of our physical examinations, and then when the pathologist does their study, which is obviously very in-depth, they will find injuries that we never saw in life, which also teaches us that our methods remain somewhat crude in being able to look at injuries in children who remain alive.
Right. I mean, one of the things that confuses me is if these symptoms, these internal symptoms, are caused by abuse, and in some cases, perhaps around half, there are no obvious signs of external abuse, such as bruises, grip marks, abrasions, things like that. How is it that these abusive people restrain themselves so well that there are no signs? Has anybody looked into how it is that half the abusers are able to do their abuse without showing any external physical signs?
Well, you know, I've had people tell me how they've done these things to children. Often they're grabbing children tightly around their chest, and the children are clothed, so the forces are not directly over the skin. And a lot of kinds of fractures are indirect forces. So if you take a baby and twist them at the ankle, and you can break their femur. And there have been several studies now that demonstrate very clearly that it's actually quite rare to have abusive bruises over fractures. Sometimes we only see these fractures in their healing states. We see many healing rib fractures or extremity fractures. And you know, we're not getting an accurate history. People are saying there were no bruises there, but how do we really know? We have one study from 1999 where when children were finally diagnosed with abusive head trauma, the researchers looked back, and they found that a certain percentage of those children were missed, a third were missed. And the children that were more likely missed on their first medical evaluation had evidence of bruises that were overlooked by physicians in very young infants. We now have many studies that demonstrate what a high risk factor bruises in very young infants are for leading to subsequent abuse. And I myself experience this in my clinical practice, that it is very difficult for a primary care physician or an outside physician to want to call abuse on a very young infant who might have unexplained bruising, and then that child goes on to end up far more injured later on, and we've seen this over and over again. So we know that bruises are caused from indirect forces, and you may not see bruises over the actual site of the fracture, and bruises are often precede a final abusive injury.
But the presence of a bruise is essentially internal bleeding, correct?
A bruise is bleeding into the skin, broken blood vessels
right.
that bleed into the skin, and that you can see it externally through the superficial layers of the skin.
Right. And, I mean, there are other ways to get bruises and to get internal bleeding in the brain other than abuse. Is that correct?
That's correct. In 2006, I wrote a book. I edited a book, and it has two chapters on common mimics of abusive head trauma. There are other ways that children have subdural hemorrhages. There are other medical conditions that cause subdural hemorrhages. The concept of differential diagnosis is a concept that we are trained in as physicians from the moment we start in medical school. We have to think about all the possibilities. And so, yes, there are many causes of subdural hemorrhage. When all of these causes are collated together, trauma is the leading cause. It doesn't mean it's the only cause, but we are obligated as physicians to evaluate the many possibilities that could result in a small amount of bleeding over the surface of the head and that of the brain, and that includes, you know, bleeding disorders, metabolic diseases, infectious diseases, congenital diseases. So, yes, we're very familiar in the medical system about going about ruling out these disorders.
And are all physicians equally capable of doing differential diagnosis in a specific case of external bleeding without any obvious physical signs?
Well, all physicians is a very broad statement. I can only speak to the way that I practice medicine and that my close colleagues practice medicine in my field called child abuse pediatrics, which is a board-certified specialty of pediatrics. And my experience is, and this is transmitted across the field, is that the less experienced physicians are more likely to overcall the cause of subdural bleeding in our rural hospitals. Fortunately, they often send infants with subdural bleeding or any kind of brain injury to the tertiary centers and the children's hospitals. So, and we get involved. And, you know, I think what's an unsung piece of this, and about half of the head trauma children that we see that come in as suspected abuse, we're the ones who are skilled, the child protection team are the ones who are skilled at saying, wait a minute, just because this child has a subdural hematoma or some other finding, maybe a couple of retinal hemorrhages, doesn't mean it's abuse. We need to look for other factors. And I think that's the myth that Dr. Turkheimer attempted to perpetuate, that somehow or another the child protection teams are overzealous because they're aligned with prosecutors. And really, if the child protection teams weren't there in tertiary medical centers, utilizing also our colleagues, which include radiologists, ophthalmologists, orthopedic surgeons, neurologists, intensive care doctors, there would be a lot more children who would be diagnosed with abuse.
So you're saying that about half of the cases that are referred to you because of a physician who's not a specialist in child abuse pediatrics, that about half of them you say are not abuse?
That's correct.
But I mean, doesn't that strengthen the claim of Professor Turkheimer that back in the 80s and 90s, that people without possibly the same skills at differential diagnosis were over-diagnosing abuse, and that there may have been people sentenced to long prison sentences based on a less expert opinion that couldn't separate out the non-abuse causes of this bleeding?
Well, what I'm saying is I've been practicing since 88, 90, and my experience is that we try to be exquisitely careful. I'm not saying there could not be cases where people are inappropriately convicted based on less than perfect evidence. I'm not saying that. But what I do say is that I don't think there's, quote-unquote, earth-shatteringly new science or a consensus that a subdural hematoma in some circumstances with retinal hemorrhages, a certain type of retinal hemorrhages with certain types of brain injury could not be due to abuse. My personal experience is very few people are convicted based solely on the triad. And if that's a concern, why is just the Innocent Project bringing in certain physicians to give them that information? My groups have approached the Innocent Projects and the Medill School of Journalism to say, let's have a balanced argument and look at these cases together and talk about the real consensus. And repeatedly, that approach has been rebuffed.
Right. So are you saying that you don't believe that there are very many people convicted based solely on the triad?
In my experience, I would have to say that there's often much, much more than just the triad. If a physician says, there's just the triad, let's, you know, this guy abuses kid or this woman abuses child, there's an investigation, there's an interrogation, there's evaluation of all of the medical factors, there's recreations of the scene. Every case is individual, and every case is complex. So I think to say that there are thousands of people in our prison systems today that were convicted solely based on the triad, I would have to look at those individual cases and say, really, was this case convicted solely based on the triad? Most of my cases that go to court are not solely based on the triad. And that's been true for 20 years.
I mean, the whole purpose of her book, and this is something that Professor Turkheimer emphasized in the interview, was that she was only considering legal cases that were only based on the triad, and there was no other evidence. And her whole book is based on these cases, and she said she was pretty sure there were hundreds of people in jail based on that, but she didn't know if it would get up to the total of thousands. But there is no accurate count of people who've been sent to jail. But in the case studies that she did based on trial transcripts, she was focused solely on convictions based solely on the triad.
So trial transcripts can be very flawed. If you know about a case and you read the trial transcript, you know there's much more behind it than the trial transcript. Judges can rule on eliminating evidence of old fractures, of other injuries that might be associated with this caregiver. Sometimes you're allowed to speak of that. If you know the real facts behind some of Dr. Turkheimer's cases in her book, you know it's only one side of the story.
So do you know specifically about some of those cases in that book and that you know that there's more to it than what was in the transcript?
Yes.
Or are you just...
No, I know that.
So you know that in some of these cases there was evidence of abuse that the judge did not allow, and yet he allowed the triad information to go forward.
It would
seem to a judge...
Well, I know that there's cases that where the trial transcripts and what's in the book was not an accurate presentation of the case.
And can you speak specifically about some of those cases?
Well, I don't want to on the station, but I do know that. And I think that it would be, you know, everybody can recognize those cases in the book because they're very poorly concealed. And I think that what happens in a trial is not the same thing as what happens in medicine. And when we start defining medicine by the legal system, we're going to be in trouble. Because, you know, we're not going to go to court and have a judge determine what my diagnostic criteria is of a heart attack. You would die in the meantime.
Right.
And I think this is where the problem lies. This is where, you know, we're allowing the legal system to define how we practice medicine. And I think that's where the problem is. And the legal system is adversarial by nature. And
right.
I've been in courtrooms where, you know, the person got acquitted for whatever reason. I understand that's our legal system. When a person gets acquitted, it's not because necessarily they weren't guilty or they didn't do it. It may be because that the prosecutor just didn't, and the state just didn't raise to the standard of a reasonable doubt. And that's our system. And the defense has a much lower standard. They just have to prove reasonable doubt. And we go with that, and that's a good system. I'm not opposed to the system at all. But when I go into court with my opinions about timing, about injuries, I don't hang my ego on what the jury's going to decide, because I know that they may not understand all the medical. An expert may be brought in to really not tell the truth. I mean, I've been in courtrooms listening to these other experts, and they really are not telling the truth.
Yes, I mean, I understand, you know, people have different perspectives, and I understand that expert witnesses can be biased based on who's paying their salary, in effect, because, I mean, expert witnesses are sometimes paid multiple hundreds of dollars an hour, so they can feel somewhat aligned with whoever's paying them. But isn't the purpose of an expert, I mean, apart from representing the truth, isn't the purpose of an expert being able to make complicated technical information understandable by a jury? And so don't you feel that that's your job, is to make it easy for the jury to make a determination on medical evidence that they normally would not know enough about?
Yes, I see my job when I go to court as a teacher of the jury. And it's complex. Every case is very complex and nuanced. And you can't expect a lay jury to understand that. So we do work very hard to try and teach the jury about the medical facts in lay terminology.
Right. One of the things that in Turkheimer's book that she talked about sometimes is that the confessions had been extracted based on the fact that when a caregiver discovered a child lifeless, that they would pick them up and shake them to see if they could, you know, get them to wake them up, or, you know, thinking, wondering if they were asleep. And that, in some cases, was turned into evidence of shaking, and that the people who had shaken the child maybe not all that hard became convinced themselves that they had shaken the child so hard that they could cause this this abuse. I mean, do you think, I mean, I know our legal system sometimes, or at least in theory, is supposed to be in favor of the accused, but in many cases, if the police want a conviction, they will interrogate people for many hours, and they will use psychological tricks to try to get somebody to confess. Don't you agree with that?
I don't know. You know what? I can't speak to what the police do. I think that confessional data can be flawed. But what if there is any confession that is accurate, then there's something about that confession. All confessions cannot be wrong. All confessions cannot be coerced. There may be some. Now, I don't go to confessions. I don't interrogate people. On occasion, in my practice, I have people just say to me, "I'm sorry, I shook the baby. I just shook him really hard because he was crying, and then he stopped and never woke up." I mean, that wasn't me in an interrogation room. That was me as a pediatrician saying, "We're just trying to figure out what happened to your baby. We have some injuries." And they spontaneously say those things. It's not like I'm saying, "Oh, you must have shook him," or "What happened after they were unconscious?" That's not my goal.
Right.
When I first see families, I try to go in with an open mind, and I see children, I say, "We're just trying to figure out what happened to your baby. That's all." And half a dozen times over the course of my practice, that's what people said to me. And so when people say, "Oh, you cannot shake a baby hard enough to hurt it without breaking its neck or causing neck injury," I'm like, wait a minute. That's not my clinical experience. Now, clinical experience is seriously dismissed by the Innocence Project, but I have to incorporate that clinical experience into the studies, into the evidence, into the science, and say, what correlates with what we see on the ground? What correlates with what we're seeing in the over and over and over again in our children's hospitals and emergency departments. How are children injured, and what does real injury look like? And what does accidental injury look like? And what does metabolic disease look like? And what do infectious diseases look like? And, you know, I think to dismiss that physicians are so ignorant that they can't discern these differences through their testing and their clinical experience is a simplistic form of legal double talk.
But isn't your knowledge basically based upon a belief that has been generated in each case about whether the parents are telling the truth or lying? Because there are many cases that in Turkheimer's book where there were people who maintained their innocence over many years. And so if you believed that person, then you would have to assume that the damage to the baby was caused by something else. And if you felt the person was lying, then you could conclude that it was abuse. So
I don't have a lie detector. I don't have a lie detector in my body. My job as a physician is not to determine who did what to whom. That's police. That's the jury to make a conviction. My job is to make a diagnosis, to listen to the family, to determine whether or not the injury is consistent or we're finding an alternative medical explanation. And I have found those alternative medical explanations. That's a good day for me to say, wow, you know what? The good news is the other doctor was wrong, and this is not abuse. But we found a condition that your child has that might have resulted in these findings. So, you know, my job is not to determine the truth or the falseness of what a family member says. My job is to take that history. Most physicians are trained to take the history at face value and say, tell me what happened to your child, or tell me what your child's medical history is, and what is your family history, and is there any hints of genetic diseases, and, you know, is your child developing normally? Have they been ill at all in the past few weeks? What was their birth like? You know, was it a difficult birth? So, you know, this is what I'm trained to do. I'm not trained to figure out if the person's lying to me.
No, but I guess what I'm saying is, if in a particular case where there are triad-like symptoms and no other evidence, and the person is convicted, then it would be reasonable for a doctor to use that as an example of this is what happens with abuse. But if it later turned out that there was a cause for those symptoms that was not known at the time, then it would mean that physicians were using symptoms that had a natural cause or had maybe an artificial cause, such as an adverse reaction to a drug or something, and using that as evidence of abuse. Like, it would multiply. If a mistake was made in a trial legally, then it would have medical consequences.
So we carefully review drugs and things that children are on and their known side effects. I don't know of a drug that a child would have an adverse reaction to that would cause the type of retinal hemorrhages we see in abuse. It's another thing that happens in when people say, well, there's 98 different causes of retinal hemorrhages. Yeah, there might be, but you have to take the type, the configuration, the distribution of those retinal hemorrhages in the context of the overall case and what other injuries the child might have. And so we did a study a couple years ago because people were proposing that there was this medical condition that children acquired that looked just like shaken baby syndrome. And I said, well, I've never heard of that. Well, let me do the literature search. And I did it, and I couldn't find that. So we did a study that absolutely disproved that statement. So in my experience, people are making up diseases to try and explain why children look the way they do without the evidence that they need, the studies behind it. Because when we really look and do those studies, and because the study refutes this medical condition that's been proposed so many times in these convictions.
And what is this medical condition?
It's called a cortical venous sinus thrombosis. That's a really big word, I know. It's a blood clot in the big veins of the head.
Right.
And about 5 or 6 years ago, I had a case of a baby that passed away, and she had terrible brain injury. She had terrible retinal hemorrhages. She had many broken bones of different ages, and she had burns on her chest and back. Okay? So, right. And she had bruises. So she had it all. We would have called that child a battered child.
Yeah.
And the defense expert came to court and said, oh, well, there was this little bit of a clot in her main vein of her head, and that's what caused everything. And plus, she had brittle bone disease, and plus, she might have had a bleeding disorder, and plus, I'm not going to comment on the burns. That's the kind of stuff that's being put through the courts.
I mean, that is a case of external evidence of abuse. Which was not really what Professor Turkheimer was talking about. I mean, I agree, and I think I know Turkheimer said this too, that abuse exists, and there are cases which have external signs that could lead you to believe that the internal factors are also related to abuse. But
right. However, the challenge is. That many of the cases and the people that are following Turkheimer's and the Innocence Projects and the post-conviction relief that are initiated by Turkheimer's work are not based just upon the triad. I have two cases right now where the post-conviction relief that's based on this Innocence Project is not just based on the triad. It's based on multiple external injuries, fractures, bruises, including a man who said that, yes, he shook the baby, but with every shake, her head struck the floor. So basically, he testified in court that every time he shook her, he bashed her head against the floor, and she died.
And yet, was there evidence of, like, external damage to the skull?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, there was.
So we're getting back. I mean, I was hoping to focus on cases, the ones that Turkheimer's book was exclusively limited to, which is the ones that were convicted solely on the basis of the triad. But you're saying that
she's
not
telling
the truth.
That's what she's saying in her book, that they're convicted solely on the basis of a triad, based on trial transcripts and what the person says. I think the book needs to be deconstructed a little bit and more honesty placed on some of these cases. So take, for example, the triad. We don't use the triad as the concept. It might be a starting place to say this child presents with a bad brain. They're unconscious. We did a head CT. We found pretty severe brain injury and a subdural hematoma. The subdural hematoma isn't necessarily what causes that brain injury. The subdural hematoma might have other causes. It might be related to the trauma. And then we look in the eyes and we see retinal hemorrhages that are extremely bad, including maybe even detached retinas, where the retinas are separated from the cells. That's a totally different case than a kid who comes in who might have a seizure. We see a little subdural after a fall. There's no sign of contact or bruise on the external body. We get an ophthalmology exam. There's two or three retinal hemorrhages. Those are not the same cases. And so I think that they have to be separated out. You can't just use, quote-unquote, the triad as the starting point.
A subdural hematoma is basically bleeding inside the brain and the collection of blood inside the brain?
It is.
Yeah, and that can cause pressure on the brain.
Well, it may cause pressure in rare circumstances. So if the subdural hematoma is large and continuing to bleed, yes, it may cause pressure on the brain. Most of the subdurals we see in abusive head trauma are not causing pressure on the brain. What is causing pressure on the brain is injury to the brain itself. So the brain is swelling. The subdural hematoma has very little to do with the brain swelling. Subdural hematoma is a marker that there's been some kind of event happened to the brain. So many young infants will stop breathing after they've suffered from head trauma. And so they stop breathing, and then they suffer from what's called hypoxia or lack of oxygen.
Right.
That causes brain swelling. So the idea that the subdural causes pressure on the brain is only based upon if the subdural is very large and expanding and continuing to grow. And actually, those are unusual circumstances. Most of the subdurals themselves don't cause pressure on the brain. Kids can walk around and actually look fairly normal with very small subdurals.
Right. Turkheim was concerned that there was, that if bleeding on the brain started, that there was, I think what she referred to as the lucid interval between when whatever injury had happened due to congenital disorder, due to an adverse reaction, due to many different things, when there would be a very slow and minor decline in health, and then as the bleeding and swelling got worse, there would be a rapid decline, and that would be at the time where there was a danger that a caregiver would be falsely accused.
Yeah, I don't know those situations. I think that's a false perception of that a child can walk around with a bleeding brain and be acting totally normal. Now, there are...
You just said that was possible. You just said that with a small hematoma, that the children would behave totally normally.
That's right, but that's because that bleeding hematoma is stable. And they don't continue... They can continue to bleed, but they don't generally. You find them coincidentally. The lucid interval depends upon a lot of factors. Right. Number one, if you have a child who has a minor injury, and I've been involved in many of these cases where the child may have a seizure, the seizure is not a good factor in determining when an injury occurred. You look back, the child has a little bit of a subdural. They kind of look okay now. They've had many caregivers. I have a case just like this. I don't know that the last person who was with this child was the one who injured him.
Yeah.
On the other hand, when you have fatal brain injury, there's absolutely, there's very little evidence. There's one case report in the entire literature that it would be so rare to have a child who actually died from a very small subdural and brain swelling to not have symptoms. When we're talking about infants, the lucid interval is a false concept because a lucid interval is an adult term. Because, a lucid interval, when we're talking after a head injury, like Natasha Richardson, she had a head injury,
right.
She was talking, she had a different kind of bleed on her brain, she had a headache, and then suddenly she dropped and she died, or she became brain dead.
But I mean,
so when we look at infants, we look for subtle things that suggest they were symptomatic over that past week or two period. We look at their head circumference, we look at their feeding schedules, we look at their weights, we talk to other people who were around them. So if a child is happy, smiling, interactive, doing things that infants normally do, it's very likely that that child isn't suffering from a fatal condition where their brain is just going to suddenly...
Right. So you would agree with Professor Turkheimer that if there was evidence of a decline in the child's health, like not eating as well, crying more, things like that, that would argue against the last caregiver being responsible for the fatal injuries?
That could argue against the last caregiver, if depending on what the fatal injury is. Now, children are repetitively abused. That's a very difficult situation to sort out from a medical perspective. If someone, we know this, I sent you the Adamsbaum article, which is a French article, and it was published in Pediatrics, and confessions don't really help them get lower sentences in their system. So I think that's why it's a little bit compelling. And what caregivers tell us in that article is when babies cry, they shake them, and then the baby stops crying and then recovers, and they shake them again, and then they stop crying. And so there might be an additive effect of that injury. So one of the challenges, and I agree it's a challenge, is to try and figure out whether the previous symptoms were due to repetitive abuse or whether they're due to another medical condition. And we try and work that through very carefully.
Right. Changing to a slightly different subject, you commented on Professor Turkheimer saying that child abuse specialists were often aligned with the prosecution. And she also commented that there was a resource imbalance, because the state could bring in as many experts as they wanted. And in many cases in the 80s and 90s, there were no experts on the side of the accused. Does your institution represent the defense in some cases, or is it always representing the prosecution?
No, I have actually worked defense cases on occasion. I'm happy to look at defense cases. I have a big workload, so I have to be careful, but there's no restriction against us looking at a defense case. You sort of have to do it out of your area, because you don't want to ruin your collegial relationships, or, you know, if you're a referral center, you're not going to look at a defense case that was within your own institution that your own partners did. But I've done that. I've looked at defense cases.
Have you testified for the defense in court?
I have. Yes, I have.
And did you see that, when your services are required by the prosecution, I mean, who pays for that? Is it the state that pays, or who pays?
Yeah, actually, the state will pay our institution for the time we're out of the hospital. I mean, so it doesn't go to us personally, because it's what we do. I mean, we would normally be working, we're getting our salary, but, you know, we're moving towards that, because I think that everybody ought to get paid for the skills. Defense experts are getting paid a lot for their work. And my experience nowadays is that when cases are publicly defended, the state is also paying huge amounts of money for some of these highly paid defense experts. And that may be fair. I've heard recently of a case where they wouldn't bring in any more prosecution experts, but they were bringing in a lot of defense experts. So I think it depends. I mean, it does. They're trying to balance it out to bring in at least, I think there needs to be somebody to talk about and represent the defendant on the medical issues. I don't disagree with that at all.
And
they just
have
to be a reputable person whose work is in child abuse, or has some clinical attachment, sees kids, evaluates kids, understands the nature of the work, sees normal kids. You know, the problem is sometimes these defense experts have never done a child abuse evaluation. Some have, but many have never been involved from the ground up on evaluating child abuse. They only do cases for the defense.
Yeah, I'm sure there are cases of doctors who have only done cases for the prosecution as well. I think the famous case in Canada was Dr. Charles Smith at the Sick Children's Hospital in Toronto, whose entire list of decisions is basically overturned. But
so
as far as I know,
he was a forensic pathologist, and I think that Justice Gouge, who did the Gouge report on, or the mm-hmm. Gouge report, however you want to say it.
Yeah, I don't know how to pronounce it either.
You know, partly in Canada, forensic pathologists were not certified. And certainly there can be bad apples in a barrel. But, you know, many of the cases were upheld. There may have been some cases that were found to be unsafe and the convictions were overturned. But really, the report is really about training and certification of forensic pathologists, so you have a much more uniform approach and a training approach, like we do in the United States.
But pathologists don't see healthy children, right? I mean, pathologists work with tissues and things like that, and samples of blood and brain.
Well, hopefully the pathologist sees a variety of things that include illnesses that kill children and accidents mm-hmm. that kill children, as well as abusive injuries that kill children. In the best possible world, is where the pathologists work closely with the clinicians in the hospitals. And I take every opportunity I can to go to the autopsy and to discuss the clinical case with the pathologist, who then understands, you know, I don't, in, he does something, he or she does something totally different than I do, and they have skills that are different than mine, but I have skills that are different than the pathologist. I understand children and the illnesses of children and how they develop and how they get injured, and so the best situation is to collaborate with a pathologist, and we do that through our child death review committees, and most states have child death review committees. And where pathologists come together with all the other clinicians and investigators to discuss the cases.
Okay. I wanted to ask you about the biomechanical issue, because Turkheimer stated that some experts had claimed that the forces that were at work in the child's brain to cause the injuries that were seen were equivalent to an accident at 50 to 60 miles per hour or a fall of 3 to 4 stories. And in the American Association of Pediatrics statement that you sent to me, it basically said that this is still an open area, that there is evidence saying that these forces can be generated, evidence saying that they can't. What's your position on, first of all, is this analogy correct, and is there biomechanical evidence that a adult can create these forces in an infant?
So I think that the problem is we're not allowed to shake living infants. There is some shaking of animals going on, not primates. That the biomechanical models that are being studied are not infants yet. In fact, we don't even have what engineers would call the parameters or the thresholds for actual infant injury. It's always scaled down from adult brains, which are different, and different water consistency and different infant brains are not adult brains. So I think that one paper that's often quoted by Dr. Bandak has that the infant must have neck injury if they were shaken has been reputed by two independent engineering and disputed by two engineering firms that were engineers. I don't do the calculus. They can do the calculus.
Right.
And the mathematical calculations have said he was wrong. His calculations are wrong. He was off by a power of 10. And, you know, and that paper gets quoted profusely, but not the other engineering reports that used the same exact calculations. So we know that biomechanics can be flawed. One study showed that if you drop a crash test dummy on the ground, you generate a lot of G-forces. Well, is a crash test dummy a baby? And are there different effects? What we know when children fall, and most of the kids that we see fall and hit their head, actually do really well. They actually do great. I mean, I saw two kids over the weekend. One fell 4 feet, one fell 6 feet. They actually had little skull fractures. They did great. You know, I had a kid who fell 8 feet. If you look at kids who fall, the mortality rate of kids who fall out of windows is about 2% in kids who fall more than two stories. And the kids start dying at 3 to 5 stories. So, you know, there's something different wrong with the biomechanics. I think as we get better models, as we get better in computer models, it will help us. The models are flawed because they're not infants, but we may get better and better as we go along.
But isn't, I mean, in the legal system, that's cold comfort to somebody who's been sentenced to life in prison to say that we actually don't have a model that proves that you could have generated that force, but we think that in the future we might be able to prove it.
What we have is analogous injuries, and I think you're right that we shouldn't say this is equivalent to a 60-mile crash or a 3-story fall. But what we have is people in our trauma centers who see these injuries all the time. Under what circumstances do you see a similar injury, right?
Right.
I mean, if you see those similar injuries under similar circumstances hundreds of thousands of times a year in those accidental parameters, And then you see a kid who supposedly fell 2 feet on the floor and has those same injuries. That's got to cause you to set back and say, what's going on here?
But you're also saying that similar injuries can be caused by things other than abuse. So you don't necessarily need severe force to create bleeding in the brain if you have a congenital injury or something like that.
So you may not, but those look very different from different kinds of trauma. So that's why I'm saying that each case is complex and nuanced and requires a careful analysis. If you've ruled out congenital problems, infections, and all the metabolic diseases, birth injuries, you got to be left with trauma at the end of the day. And we work really hard to not say it's trauma if it's not trauma. And many, many times we have other indicators of trauma that go along with that. Most of the time we do.
Okay, the AAP statement said, the importance of impact and acceleration-deceleration injury was supported by the basic biomedical models, biomechanical models, and they concluded that the most serious abusive head injuries required an impact to the head. So wouldn't that show external signs of damage to the baby?
No, what the Duhaime study showed of the late 80s is that impact could be against a soft surface. Really what impact was a sudden stopping of the acceleration-deceleration. And so you may not see a sign of impact. And also in the worst cases, in the fatal cases, many times it takes an autopsy to see the sign of impact. You can't see it on x-rays. You can't see it on your clinical exam. But when the pathologist looks under the scalp in ways that we can't do in living children, that sign of impact is there. So we know we're limited by our external examinations. We also know, and I've had people say, I shook the baby and threw them hard on the couch or the bed, and they have no external signs of impact, but they have severe brain injury, and that's impact.
But it doesn't have to be impact. I mean, there is severe injury, brain injury, without an impact, right, with
yes,
medical.
Yeah, injury. I think, in my opinion, you can violently shake an infant without impact, because people have demonstrated it to me. Some of the animal studies are supportive of this. We see kids who have neck strains. When we image their necks, they're not necessarily broken necks. And we know that they've suffered acceleration, deceleration, and flexion extension of their neck by their constellation of injuries.
If you knew that a baby had been recently vaccinated or medicated in the week or 2 weeks leading up to the fatal incident, would you consider that in your differential diagnosis?
So there's absolutely zero evidence that vaccines cause anything that looks like abusive head trauma. Zero. There's suspicion. There's people who say it does. But what makes a kid abused after a vaccination is usually they're irritable and they're crying. If a child is taking a medication that influences their ability to clot or bleed, that would influence if a child's on heart medicine, if they've just had surgery. Children are rarely on blood thinners, but sometimes they are.
Yeah.
So the chronic medical conditions always influence, and the medications we go through carefully through their list. There's some of the anti-seizure medicines that a child may be on could influence their ability to clot. Yes, we do consider those things.
But doesn't your refusal to consider vaccine problems, I mean, there have been fatal reactions to vaccines, so wouldn't it be possible for internal bleeding to be caused by an adverse reaction to a vaccine? Like, why is that completely out of the realm of possibility?
Well, nowadays we're using acellular vaccines, those very complex. They were encephalitis. As far as I know, they were not associated with bleeding on the brain. They were associated with an encephalopathy and brain swelling with no bleeding on the brain. They were not associated with the severe retinal hemorrhages that we have seen. So we haven't seen a case that is associated with that. We have seen vaccine-related injuries, but they look quite different than these. We've never seen a case that or anybody reported, or a series of cases, or scientific evidence. So it's not that I'm dismissing it out of hand. It's just not there.
But defense lawyers have on occasion brought up the fact that there was vaccination shortly before the injury. So there are some people who believe it could cause these problems. Is that
defense lawyers, correct? I guess, but not doctors.
But defense experts.
Well, they're basing their opinion on conjecture, and we're basing our opinion on science.
But how can there be science unless there is a double-blind, randomized, controlled trial, in which case in which you inject vaccines and try to see if you get certain injuries? Then everything's based on
conjecture.
We're
never going to have
right?
that randomized, controlled trial.
No.
We're never going to have that randomized, controlled trial. What we have to depend upon is literally the millions and millions and millions of children are vaccinated every year who do very well with their vaccines, and better as time goes on. When we had the whole cell pertussis, we saw much more encephalopathy, but with the acellular pertussis and acellular vaccines, I mean, the early rotavirus vaccine caused a problem called intussusception. The new rotavirus doesn't. So, you know, vaccines may have had certain kinds of complications,
mm-hmm.
but... You know, we have to depend upon the literally millions and millions of children who get vaccines, who do very, very well. That is the scientific evidence. You can't have double-blind randomized control studies where you don't vaccinate some kids and do. That would never, ever pass muster at any IRB, nor would it be ethical.
Right.
It wouldn't be ethical.
Yes. Well, that's a whole other long discussion, and we've come to the end of our hour, and I would just like to thank you very much for giving the other side of shaken baby syndrome, abusive head trauma, and I appreciate your input, and I hope that our listeners...
I appreciate your time. I appreciate you allowing us to stop me this time.
Well, thank you. Thanks again, and also thanks to our listeners as well for joining us for this hour. Thank you, and goodbye.
Goodbye.